This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1984, when Bruce Springsteen released his rock and roll anthem, Born in the USA, it wasn't meant to be a song that endorsed the then-President Ronald Reagan's re-election campaign, but no one told Reagan.
America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your hearts. It rests in the message of hope in songs of a man so many young Americans admire, New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen.
Still, with or without that song, Reagan easily won re-election, and campaign songs continued to be used as a call to arms to win over voters and to rock out rallies. What is it about music and presidential political campaigns? The messaging and melody shapes a candidate's image, and it's an important part of their strategy to capture the White House. Eric T. Casper is the co-author of the book, You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music in the 2016 Presidential Election and Beyond.
When President Reagan was running for his re-election in 1984, he ends up making reference, actually, to the Springsteen song "Born in the USA." He talks about it at one of his rallies, and this generates a little bit of controversy for a couple of reasons. Number one is that Springsteen, of course, was then and has been since then a large supporter of the Democratic Party and a supporter of Democratic candidates, so he was not particularly pleased with it being used as a way to help get President Reagan reelected. But also the song itself, even though it has the kind of this overriding on its surface, this notion that it's this very positive idea. You know, the name of the song is "Born in the USA," and it kind of gets used sometimes as this patriotic theme. The song itself is actually, if you look at the lyrics, it's reflecting the negative experiences of a Vietnam veteran who comes back home after the war, and issues that are raised in the song, not only about the difficulties of war. And being a soldier in war, but also about the economic situation for soldiers coming back as veterans. And so, the song itself was meant to have a different message than how it was used by the campaign. Of course, on top of that, the songwriter was not in agreement with the political beliefs of the campaign itself, and so it generated some controversy for those reasons. Similar to the way that the Reagan campaign in that same year was using Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, which was meant to be a very patriotic song to extol lots of virtues about the United States. But Born in the USA, had the intent there by Springsteen was much different.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. An American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
just kind of a natural choice, particularly in that year, to make use of it. But we've seen other campaigns use it since.
Yeah, it's become a hallmark of many of these campaigns. But when you actually look at the song and the contents of the song, like many of these campaign speeches, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Well, and that's, you know, it goes to one of the reasons why campaign songs typically are used the way that they are, which is to express the similar themes to what candidates are going to say in their stump speeches, right? And even though stump speeches are filled with lots of rhetoric and, you know, may not get into the heart of specific, you know, empirically the what specific policies might do or will do, and what the perhaps negative effects might be of what the policy proposals are of a candidate. Nevertheless, those speeches are filled with rhetoric, and campaigns then use music to get that type of message across in a different way, but it's meant to have the same effect. And so in that respect, it's not surprising that's the song choice that is made both by Reagan in 1984 and by other candidates since. You know, you could try to get more complex. You could try to dig into these things in song lyrics a little bit more, and some of those songs could be used and sometimes are used by campaigns. But oftentimes, if they are being used by a candidate that is trying to defeat an incumbent, right? And they're trying to use a song that's critical of what's occurring and gets into those details a little bit more as a way to attack the incumbent candidate.
Sure. And so campaign songs are not complex policy papers where they're going to be talking about monetary issues and how they're going to hold inflation in check. They're supposed to be, like it's written in the book, audio optics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're supposed to create a feeling.
Right. And, you know, that is done in combination oftentimes between the actual music and the lyrics. And in particular, as we're in the modern era, where the overwhelming majority of songs that are used by campaigns are existing pop songs, it can be very difficult to find the song that is already written that's tailored to specific policy planks of a candidate's platform. But nevertheless, right, they tend to be searching for songs that have some sort of connection to a big theme of the campaign, right? So in that sense, God Bless the USA is about, you know, patriotism and, you know, the kind of going hand in hand with Reagan's 1984 campaign motto of "It's morning in America," right? Things are going great. And again, that's a very common theme for incumbents who are running. Barack Obama in 2012 using "Let's Stay Together." Things are good. Let's keep it going. A very different approach by Bill Clinton, for instance, in 1992. Kind of this, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, right?
The Fleetwood Mac song.
Yeah, which is a song that much like "Born in the USA," "Don't Stop" by Fleetwood Mac was written with a very different purpose in mind. But nevertheless, you know, it's a song that makes you think about, you know, things aren't going that well, and we need to keep in mind how we can make a better tomorrow than what we have today, right? Again, that wouldn't be typically the best choice for an incumbent, unless you were, as Clinton was in 96, continuing the use of the same song, but it works very well for someone who is trying to defeat that incumbent.
Let's go to break with Fleetwood Mac's "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow," And when we come back, we will hear how the Founding Fathers used music in their campaigns. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is a campaign song for the first president, George Washington.
The day is broke, my lads, march on and follow, follow Washington. He will lead the way, my lads, is he that leads the way. Where he commands, we shall obey, through rain and snow, by night and day. Determined to be free, my lads, determined to be free. Till freedom reigns, our happy bands will fight like true Americans. Until our cause prevails, my lads, until our cause prevails. With heart in hand and God our trust, we'll freely fight. Our cause is just, march on, my lads. Lads, march on and follow Washington. The day is broke, my lads, march on and follow, follow Washington. 'Tis he that leads the way, my lads, 'tis he that leads the way.
Music has been a part of American presidential campaigns since some of the earliest campaigns.
Eric T. Casper is the co-author of the book, You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music in the 2016 Presidential Election and Beyond.
If you go back to, for instance, Washington's re-election campaign, or the campaigns where John Adams or Thomas Jefferson won, what you see are existing songs that are repurposed. The lyrics are rewritten to say something very specific about the campaign, trying to emphasize either the candidate that the song is for and kind of what their themes are. And a lot of these early songs, you know, have the word liberty somewhere in the title, or that have that emphasized somewhere, like that this is a candidate who supports protecting your freedoms, right? Or especially as you move along a little bit into the 19th century, you start to see a number of these songs also saying something negative in some way about the opponent in the general election.
Okay, the song Jefferson and Liberty, it doesn't sound very uplifting.
No, you know, and part of this might be simply the way that we're looking at it through our contemporary eyes. If you look at some of the lyrics that are in place, it's more so trying to talk about the stateliness, the appropriateness of having Jefferson in place as opposed to Adam. You're talking about some negative things without necessarily saying Adams' name, but you know, saying some negative things as far as the what was happening with the Alien and Sedition Acts, and you know, trying to say, look, if Jefferson's elected, this sort of thing isn't going to occur.
So that's when we talk about Jefferson and Liberty in the title, that's what they're referring to. The loss of freedom in the United States at the time because of the Sedition Act,
right,
which would put people in jail for criticizing Congress and the president.
Exactly. And so that was something that Jefferson campaigns strongly against. You know, he's got the, you know, as the song begins, you know, it starts out by, you know, the gloomy night before us flies, the reign of terror now is over. And again, not necessarily meant to be uplifting in a direct sense of, you know, hey, times are great. But again, if you're running as the challenger, right, you have to make, in some way, your music tends to emphasize things that are not that great.
The gloomy night before us flies, the reign of terror now is o'er. It's gags, inquisitors, and spies, it's heads of harpies are no more. Rejoice, Columbia sons, rejoice, to tyrants never bend the knee, but join with heart and soul and voice for Jefferson and liberty. Here arch a lift, a laurel head, wealth, industry, and peace divine, and where dark pathless forests spread, rich fields and lofty cities shine.
Rejoice, Columbia sons, rejoice, to tyrants never bend a knee, but join with heart and soul and voice for Jefferson and liberty. No lordling here with gorging jaws shall ring from me.
You know, obviously some of that is a little over the top, right? You know, the Adams campaign wasn't seeing itself as engaging in a reign of terror. But the song here saying, you know, there are some things that have gone wrong under the current president, and, you know, things will be better if our candidate is elected. And that kind of generic message that runs throughout the song is a theme that exists in a lot of campaign songs throughout all of American history.
And how would people be able to experience this song?
There would be a few ways. You know, there might be some sort of campaign event where the music is a part of that.
I mean, like today, like you go to a campaign rally.
Right, similar to what we would see today.
Huzzah for Madison, huzzah for Union and America. Huzzah for Madison, huzzah for Union and America. And should the Tories all unite and join again with British foes, though Satan might applaud the sight, the heavens would soon interpose. While Jefferson to shade retires and Madison like morn appears, fresh confidence and hope inspires, and light again the nation cheers. Huzzah for Madison, huzzah for Union and America. Huzzah for Madison, huzzah for Union and America.
Especially as though as you move into the, you get into the early to mid 19th century, and you see some advancements being made in the technology of the printing press. And what that results in is that it makes it much faster and much cheaper to be able to mass-produce songbooks. And so you have these songbooks being put out there by campaigns and being distributed, and so, you know, people could hold their own events where they are somewhat of a proxy for, you know, the candidates themselves. And they might have, you know, someone sitting at a piano playing this song at this event, you know, maybe in someone's home or in some sort of hall or bar room or something.
Yeah, so if you're at a tavern, would there be, like, campaign loyalists who would learn these songs and then perform them in the tavern as a campaign ad?
Yeah, that sort of thing could go on as a way to get the message of the campaign out there.
But the songs are terrifying, particularly this one that for John Quincy Adams, Little Know Ye Who's Coming. It has these lyrics that are chilling. I'm going to play it.
Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Fire's coming, swords are coming, pistols, guns, and knives are coming, famine's coming, famine's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Slavery's coming, knavery's coming, plunder's coming, wonder's coming, jobbing's coming, rabbin's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming.
Why is he saying that? Fire's coming, swords are coming, pistols, guns, knives are coming, slavery's coming, the devil's coming. What are all these things that he's talking about?
Well, you know, in part, you know, what he is referring to is this notion of, you know, if you're thinking about some of the candidates that he's running against in this four-way race in particular with Andrew Jackson, right? It's this notion that, much like when his father was running, where the concern was, you know, the over-democratization and what the effects of that have been in France. So, you know, we have to put a stop to that sort of thing happening here. What eventually emerges as a Whig versus a Democratic debate, but it's still really, they're all within the Democratic Party at this point, just different factions of the party. But this notion that, you know, you have this kind of great unkempt, unwashed masses that if they obtain too much political power and you have these voting reforms that are being advocated by Jackson and others, that you're going to have this mobocracy that develops, and that we could end up with a situation like they had in France during the French Revolution. And so it's the use of fear in campaign music as opposed to trying to be uplifting. But that is even today something that we see that gets used in the more modern era, whether it's, you know, emphasis on crime or emphasis on protecting us from foreign enemies or from terrorism.
Ye gentlemen and ladies fair who grace this famous city, just listen if you've time to spare while I rehearse a ditty. And for the opportunity, conceive yourselves quite lucky, for 'tis not often that you see a hunter from Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. We are a hardy, free-born race, each man to fear a stranger. Whate'er the game, we join in chase, despising time and danger. And if a daring foe annoys, whate'er his strength and forces, we'll show him that Kentucky boys are alligator horses. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. I suppose you've read it in the prints how Pakenham attempted to make old Hickory Jackson wince, but soon his scheme repented. For we with rifles ready cocked thought such occasion lucky, and soon around the general flock the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky.
So eventually we do have the victory and the presidency of Andrew Jackson. How did that change things?
You know, once Jackson is in power and those in his party who want to push democratization, you have this sentiment of the need to take away these property qualifications on voters in the 1830s especially. Right? So what does that do? It greatly increases the voting population, and it greatly increases the voting population or the number of people in the voting population that have little to no formal education and may not even have much of an ability to read and write.
So these songs become even more important.
Yes, and so by 1840, you start to see this massive increase in the use of campaign songs because, you know, if you were to put something on a poster or you were to put something in a pamphlet and give it to someone to let them read it, for a lot of this new class, many people in this new class of voters, the message isn't going to get through. Even newspapers aren't going to reach a lot of these new voters, right? By singing these songs, by holding events, either large events or smaller events in people's homes or at other places of business, you have this ability to get the campaign message out there and to make it into something of an earworm, right? Because you're attaching it to music. And so the ability for someone to retain what was said in a stump speech versus being able to remember some lyrics to a catchy song means that you have this ability through music to be able to have your campaign messages stick with people potentially longer.
So was more effort being put into crafting songs that would become catchy? Tipper Canoe and Tyler Too, that's pretty catchy.
It is catchy, but it's also continuing a theme that had been in existence since the very beginning, which is find a song that's already is known by the public, that's already the public likes, right, that's popular in some sense, and then write new lyrics to it, right? And in a number of cases, you know, you might take songs that were used primarily as drinking songs and, you know, repurposing the song with lyrics that applied to your campaign, right, as a way to then, you know, it's something that people could already have in their mind as far as the music, and they might be able to hum along even while it's going, but then they're going to get these new words, these new lyrics that are either extolling the virtues of the candidate or trying to say something negative about their opponent.
Oh, what has caused this great commotion, motion, motion, our country through? It is the ball that's rolling on for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, and with them we'll beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man, and with them we'll beat little Van. Oh, let them talk about hot cider, 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 and the cabins too. It will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, and with them we'll beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man, and with them we'll beat little Van.
They're not just saying positive things to make people think, you know, good things about Harrison and Tyler. It's also, you know, it's referring to, you know, throughout the song, things like, you know, we'll beat little Van. We have people talking today about, you know, the fall in stature of candidates and how negative our campaigning is, and, you know, this kind of nostalgic notion of, you know, the high-minded days when campaigns were virtuous or something, right? That the same sorts of tactics have been used for a long time and including, of course, here with respect to the lyrics used in the music.
Now, Abraham Lincoln, when he was in 1860, involved in that four-way contest, as we were heading towards Civil War, he actually was able to up the game in regards to coming up with a campaign song. He was able to basically get a musician's endorsement. How did that work?
Yeah, the Hutchinson family singers, they were, if you go back before the Civil War, they were a well-known singing troupe that they would tour the country, and they would sing various types of both ballads as well as patriotic and other types of songs. And they were very, you know, not only very from the North, not only very strongly, as you're getting into the run-up to the Civil War, very, very pro-Union, but they were also abolitionists. And so there was this, they basically got involved with the Lincoln campaign, even though he's not, in 1860, necessarily, you know, preaching, you know, abolition or bust. They kind of see him as the candidate who is closest to their views, and so they end up not only, you know, going on a bit of a tour here and performing on his behalf, but also helping to write lyrics to songs to be able to say good things about Lincoln and his campaign through their music in that way.
Let's listen to Lincoln and Liberty 2 as we go to break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. These are the campaign songs of America's presidents. Eric T. Casper is the co-author of the book, You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music in the 2016 Presidential Election and Beyond. Stay tuned.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and Liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and Liberty too. Then up with the banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. Fight till our banner's victorious for Lincoln and Liberty too. All you true friends of the nation, attend to humanity's call. Come aid in the slave's liberation and roll on the Liberty Ball. And roll on the Liberty Ball. And roll on the Liberty Ball. In the slave's liberation and roll on the Liberty Ball.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking presidential campaign music with Eric T. Casper, the co-editor of the book You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music of the 2016 Presidential Election and Beyond. In the grip of the Great Depression, Happy Days Are Here Again, a song from the 1930 film Chasing Rainbows, launched the presidential campaign of Franklin Roosevelt.
Happy days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together, shout it now, there's no one here can doubt it now. Let us tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again.
It's definitely one that has stuck. You have Happy Days Are Here Again, which, of course, is Roosevelt's message here is that as the country is descending into the Great Depression, that, you know, his message is, well, if you elect me, you know, we'll be able to return to those happy days. It's really the first instance of an existing pop song that is used by the campaign without changing any lyrics. And so in that sense, it was kind of ahead of its time because even though later on you would see some campaigns asking, you know, musical celebrities to take an existing song and to change, you know, a few words or to change some lines to refer to the campaign or the candidate, it's really not until the 1970s, 1980s that we start to see campaigns really using pop songs, you know, with all the existing lyrics staying in them. And so in that sense, what Roosevelt was doing in 1932 was really ahead of its time and was, and again, the fact that it still gets used by the Democratic Party today, I think it shows that it's not only is it an effective song that's kind of transcended time, but also it's, you know, the message of that song is one that still resonates, right? And that's very similar to Bill Clinton in 1992. About don't stop thinking about tomorrow. I mean, it's the same sort of theme that is working here with Happy Days Are Here Again.
So now we're in the mass media era of political campaigning, and they're looking to use electronic entertainment to spread their messaging. And so from 1932, we jumped to 1952, and when television is now becoming a dominant force for campaign music, and Eisenhower is able to tap into that. And what did he do?
Well, he is, of course, his campaign is very well known for the use of I Like Ike, and it's not only this, you know, catchy tune, which, you know, in and of itself as music, kind of fit, I think, in a lot of ways the advertising strategies of the day. It's kind of the political equivalent of the ad jingle, but it also is then combined with a cartoon, and the cartoon has images of people marching to the tune and carrying signs that have, you know, Ike on them in some way, and then they're being led by Uncle Sam. There's an elephant in this, the traditional symbol of the Republican Party, that's going along and has a sheet on its back with Eisenhower's picture, and has the word Ike on another one of these sheets.
But it doesn't really say anything other than this buoyant message of how likable Ike is.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a song in which there are, of course, original lyrics, but right, I mean, it's very much surface level stuff. It says, you know, I like Ike. I mean, it has some you know, negative things in terms of referring to some Democratic potential or potential challengers. You know, we don't want these candidates. Let's do that big job right. But yeah, it's very much this kind of let's bang the drum and say I like Ike. But again, I mean, it fits this notion of what we would expect from a 1950s or early 1960s type of jingle for a product.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean
or Harry,
let's do that big job right. Let's get in step with the guy that's hep.
Ike's Ike for president. Hang out the banner and beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
And if it works, it works. And so John F. Kennedy pretty much took that page right out of their playbook.
He did. And in 1960, he uses this song that is simply known as Kennedy, where it says the name Kennedy a bunch of times.
Yeah, 26 times in 60 seconds.
Right. The use of repetition, no doubt, it was on their mind.
The Mad Men must have participated in the crafting of that.
Right. Kennedy, 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 Kennedy,
Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
But it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy,
Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy.
He had another song that was associated with him, and it was sung by Frank Sinatra.
This is one of these cases where it's kind of this transition period that we see, and it's going to be the case here with High Hopes. It's going to be the case again with Lyndon Johnson taking Hello Dolly and changing it to Hello Lyndon, basically taking the existing song that's popular that's getting radio airplay and changing a few of the lyrics. Right, not changing all of them, but also not keeping not just playing the straight up pop song.
Everyone is voting for Jack, 'cause he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track, 'cause he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. 1960's the year for his high hopes. Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top. Oops, there goes the opposition girl. Oops, there goes the opposition girl. Oops, there goes the opposition girl.
And so it becomes kind of this transition era. It really starts in some respects going back into the 1940s, but really picks up in the 1960s, where you're not writing in entirely new sets of lyrics. You're taking an existing song and its lyrics, and you're making some changes to those lyrics. And in that sense, the lyrics also are going to tend to match what's going on in the music better, as opposed to completely rewriting an entire song's lyrics and then keeping the music the same. Some of those older songs, historically, the match between what the lyrics are doing and what the music is doing might not be working out that well. But you see more of that working here in when these more minor changes are made, so that campaigns start to eventually say, why don't we just take the existing song as it is and not make any changes to the lyrics, and we'll just play the pop song.
Going to break with that campaign song for Lyndon Johnson, Hello Lyndon. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Lyndon, well, hello, Lyndon. It's just great to have you there where you belong. You're looking swell, Lyndon, we can tell. Lyndon, you're still glowing, you're still growing, you're still going strong. We hear the...
In his 2000 run for the White House, George W. Bush thought the Tom Petty song, I Won't Back Down, would be a good campaign song. Petty thought, no. He sent a cease and desist letter. John Mellencamp and Sting also told Bush to stop using their music. We're talking about presidential campaign songs with Eric T. Casper, who edited You Shook Me All Campaign Long, music of the 2016 presidential election and beyond.
is a great song for a candidate, right? I mean, not only the title, not only kind of how it's got a catchy beat to it, but also this notion of, hey, you know, I'm going to be a tough politician, right? I mean, other people aren't going to intimidate me. You know, you vote for me and I'll get the job done is kind of the message you can put out there. But there have been some cases, especially the farther you go back, where campaigns were using this without securing the copyright permission to do so. And that is potentially something that can get you into legal trouble. But even with the copyright permission, sometimes this song has been used by campaigns, and you know, Petty or his representatives still put out this statement that they don't want the campaign to use their song. And typically that's resulted then in the campaign, even if they have secured the legal right to use it and they paid for the right to use it, to stop using it, because historically, at least up until 2016, it was seen as the way, even if you had the legal right to use it, it was seen as just more problematic politically to use a song when the artist is objecting. It becomes a drag on the message of the song, right? The song is meant to say something positive about your campaign. And if now news stories are popping up where, you know, you have something negative being said about your use of this music, the answer typically up until 2016 was, okay, we're just going to stop using the song, because that'll kill off the drag on our the reasons why we want to use the song in the first place.
So they did back down on using "I Won't Back Down," the Defiant anthem. I mean, Tom Petty, it's his song, and he should have some say on who can use it, right?
Well, it actually gets us into a rather complicated area. If the campaign has not gone to ASCAP or somewhere else to actually secure to pay for the right to use it, and if they're in violation of copyright law, then they could subject themselves to lawsuits, and there's some recovery that could be made by the copyright holder, who may or may not be the actual artist who is famous for singing it. But even if, and this is the area where we tend to see more of this, more of the problem today and in the more recent campaigns, which is the campaign gets the copyright permission to use it. They've paid for the rights to use it. But the artist says, well, if you're playing that at your events, or you're playing that at your national convention, it implies that I endorse you, and I don't. So, you know, they may issue a statement saying, please stop using my song. But if the copyright permissions are in place, the campaign still could say, look, we're going to continue to use it. Now, again, in before 2016, just every instance that I can find, or just about every instance I could find, even if they have the copyright permission to use it, the campaign is going to say, okay, you know, we don't want this negative publicity from the artist coming up to harm the campaign. It's just not worth it, so we'll stop using the song.
There is the issue of politicians just picking the wrong songs, you know, for their campaign. When John McCain was running for president, he wanted to go with this John Philip Sousa march song known as the Liberty Bell. A lot of people may know that as the theme to Monty Python.
You know, a similar, not in the same respect, but it's similar to, you know, as we talked about earlier, the use of Born in the USA and Reagan making use of that in 1984, right? That you're picking a song that you know, maybe you're trying to repurpose it for some other reason, but you know, if you start to look at it, start to listen to it, you're going to find that, you know, this isn't the message that you in fact really want to be projecting.
It's like using the theme music from the TV show Veep to announce your presidential campaign.
Right. Although, interestingly enough, if you want to talk about a pop culture reference that's similar to that, in 2016, the Trump campaign was actually making use of the theme music from Air Force One, the film Air Force One. Now, again, the film Air Force One kind of projects a different politician than Veep does. But nevertheless, it's another one of these cases of campaigns trying to figure out how can we make use of popular culture to have it have a positive impact on our campaign. And it doesn't always work, right? Because sometimes they fly a little too close to the sun.
Right, and that's a film where like Harrison Ford plays the president and terrorists take over Air Force One, and he is an action hero, and he's able to beat them all up.
Get off my plane.
Well, and Trump actually ends up using a lot of different classic rock songs, you know, from Dream On to Rockin' in the Free World to You Can't Always Get What You Want, you know, and so, you know, it's...
And I'm going to add one more to that. When he uses REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It, you have to wonder.
Well, it's one of these cases where you could point to any of these songs individually, and you could say, you know, this is the present day equivalent of Ross Perot using "Crazy" from Patsy Cline, right? But with Trump, I think the use of these songs. First of all, I think this largely comes down to his campaign using a lot of songs, a lot of these classic rock songs that he just personally likes. But I think there's also some sort of theme going through there. You know, you can't always get what you want. He used that especially during the primary season and continued using that during the general election, saying, hey, you might not like certain things about my campaign or about me personally, but I'm what you need.
You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you might find you get what you need. Oh, yeah. I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse, singing words gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50-amp fuse. Sing it to me. You can't always get what you want.
You've been listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about the history of music use on the presidential campaign trail. Eric T. Casper co-edited the book, You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music in the 2016 Presidential Election and Beyond. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Public Radio.